Good evening. It is 6 p.m. in the capital of the United States of America, Washington, D.C., and you are tuned to the Critical Hour here on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, political scientist, author, and nationally syndicated columnist, Dr. Wilmer Leon. And for the next hour, we will explore and analyze the salient news stories that are impacting the global village in which we live.
Welcome to the Critical Hour here with Dr. Wilmer Leon. I am Bob Schlehuber. I am filling in for the hour. Dr. Wilmer Leon will be back tomorrow. A lot of ground to cover. The latest from Iran, some immigration news, and a wrap-up of the Democratic primary through the weekend in South Carolina and South Bend, Indiana. We start the show today here with Daniel Lazar. Daniel Lazar is a journalist and author of several books, including The Frozen Republic, Velvet Coup, and America's Undeclared War. The last title there may be most apropos here for our conversation. Mr. Lazar, thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure.
Well, America's Undeclared War may be turning its eyes on Iran. Tensions flared there on Friday, as Donald Trump said. He pulled back the military from three strikes 10 minutes before they were supposed to launch against targets in Iran. I'm not sure whether or not that story is true or if it falls along Donald Trump having great health and not having bone spurs in his legs. But nonetheless, things escalated Friday, and over the weekend, there was announced cyber attacks on several Iranian capabilities, including their weapon system, the missile systems, and radar. And Donald Trump and the Trump administration announced new sanctions just this afternoon. Mr. Lazar, maybe catch us up on where things are between the U.S. and Iran, if things are escalating towards war, or if the two countries are playing a little bit of a game of chicken here and seeing who will fold first.
Well, I think it's both. I mean, I think there was a game of chicken going on. It's a very dangerous game because sooner or later, one party is going to lose. And when that happens, war could break out. I mean, Trump backed off from bombing Iran in response to the downing of the drone. And so that brought a sigh of relief to a lot of people. But the economic warfare goes on, and Trump's repudiation of the 2015 nuclear accord goes on. So the U.S. and Iran are really on a collision course. And barring a 180-degree shift on Trump's part, I can't see how a collision can be avoided.
Yeah, absolutely. And I'm curious there, the big cyber attack over the weekend was targeting Iranians' radar and missile systems. I'm curious from your perspective, if it was Donald Trump's kind of tit-for-tat response for shooting down the unmanned drone a few days beforehand, or if they were attacking the radar and missile systems to help them with a later attack down the line anytime here in the next few days, if it was just a retaliatory or if it was a preemptive strike for something much more.
I assume it was the former. I assume it was retaliatory. But what was really what amped up tensions even more is when Iran was clearly jubilant over both downing the drone and Trump's decision not to retaliate. So now Trump looks foolish and weak, and there's nothing worse than a Donald Trump who thinks that people think he's foolish and weak, because he'll have a huge incentive to prove himself. And when that happens, he could very easily overstep his bounds.
And I'm curious, there, going back to last Friday there, to get your take on what did happen. I mean, do you think Donald Trump was strategically playing the let's attack him but pull back at the last minute to show him how serious we can be for negotiation purposes? Do you think somebody within the Saudis or Israeli universe said, hey, you know what, a lot of the blowback if you strike Iran is actually going to be on us since this is in our own backyard, so maybe don't do that? Or is Donald Trump a little bit more risk-averse than we think, and he doesn't see striking Iran as being anything good for his 2020 re-election campaign?
Yeah, you know, it's really kind of all of those things. I mean, Trump's a cagey guy. I wouldn't underestimate him. And so therefore, he's capable of, sort of thinking several moves in advance. Number two, a lot of people are worried if a war breaks out because it'll lead to a conflagration that will spread throughout the entire region. It won't be pretty. Who was it who said that if you liked Afghanistan and Iraq, you'll love Iran?
Yeah.
I mean, a war like that would spread from the Persian Gulf to the Mediterranean in a flash, and the whole region could very easily, very likely, go up in flames. So my guess is that Trump, there were some you know, he didn't want to kill 150 people for no good reason. But my sense is that Trump realizes he's standing on the edge of a precipice. The results could be catastrophic if he goes over. And so I think he thought twice.
I'm curious, and for maybe several people out there, they're rather confused what exactly Donald Trump wants from the Iranians. The Iranians seemed more than happy to try to renegotiate or at least keep the plan in place, and they were following it to what international observers had said. And now Iran's looking around saying, well, if you're going to back out of this deal and not really give us much to negotiate with, then we're going to increase our uranium allotment. And here in just about 3 or 4 days, they're going to exceed the amount of uranium that they were restricted from having from the past treaty. So what exactly is Donald Trump aiming for in a new treaty with Iran?
I don't really know.
I
have an idea.
Sure.
First of all, number one, I'm not really sure if Trump knows.
Sure.
But number two, I mean, the implications of the U.S. stance at this moment are really shocking. I mean, what the U.S. is doing is it's threatening essentially to use the nuclear pressure on Iran to force Iran to stop doing things that the U.S. doesn't like. I mean, the whole purpose of the JCPOA, the nuclear accord that was negotiated in 2015, was to separate the nuclear issue from the non-nuclear issues. I mean, the U.S. is not happy that Iran is sending weapons to the Houthis in Yemen. It's not happy that it's backing President Bashar al-Assad in Syria, or that it's backing the Hezbollah in Lebanon. Whether the U.S. is correct, I'm not saying, because I actually think that Iran is actually correct to a certain degree on many of those issues. But the whole idea behind the nuclear negotiations was to put those non-nuclear issues aside and to concentrate solely on the question of nuclear weapon development. And essentially that was the rationale behind it. So Iran could play all the games that any regional power would play, but nuclear weapons would be off the table. But now what the implication of what Trump is saying is that no, we're going to use nuclear pressures to prevent Iran from doing those other non-nuclear things we don't like. And the implications are really profound, because it means essentially that the U.S. is launching a war against Iran to prevent it from countering measures taken by the Saudis or the United Arab Emirates, which are all to be expected of a country in Iran's position. The implications are very dangerous, very serious. And I don't see how Trump can sort of get out of can unpaint himself out of the corner. I mean, he's locked himself into a position, the logical outcome of which is war. And I don't see how he can escape the trap he's made for himself.
Yeah, the sanctions that I mentioned there, and I want to get some more of your thoughts here, were targeting Supreme Leader Ayatollah Khamenei, as well as the foreign minister Javad Zarif. I'm curious what your thoughts on these continued sanctions and the impact on the economy. Obviously, these top-ranking officials here in Iran have plenty of other ways to which to get money that they're not going to be immediately hit by the sanctions. But nonetheless, it's more news. It's more sanctions. Is Donald Trump winning, though, regardless of his attention and focus is to destabilize Iran and basically cause chaos within the country and its economic system? Does he actually need to go to an actual military war, and instead can he just stay at an economic war and gain whatever it is he's trying to gain?
Yeah, but economic warfare is still warfare.
Mm-hmm.
And Trump is escalating things. So it's impossible to say what it will lead to next. But it very easily could graduate in any number of ways into an actual shooting war. I mean, that's what the drone thing was about. I mean, we came within a hair's breadth of that. Iran shot down a drone, which had said, quite plausibly, by the way, that it was over its territorial waters. And the U.S. came within minutes of launching a major, powerful, retaliatory strike. And if that had happened, then Iran would very possibly have retaliated in kind. And then we'd be off to the races. So you really can't draw a sharp line between economic warfare and other kinds of warfare. And the more Trump you know, engages in one, the greater the likelihood that the other will result.
Yeah, I'm curious here in our last few minutes, where the opposition is to Donald Trump attacking Iran. You've had Bernie Sanders come out on over the weekend and talk about the need to pull back from the brink of war, but you see Democratic leadership within the Senate and House being rather supportive. Adam Schiff and Chuck Schumer, I think, basically said, if you could better articulate it, or at least if he would go through the proper channels in Congress to authorize it, they would be more than fine with the U.S. striking Iran. And that's quite shocking for the opposition party to be locked, cocked, and loaded, as Donald Trump would say in his tweet there from Friday. There's no opposition to Donald Trump doing whatever it is he's trying to do in many ways with Iran amongst the Democratic Party leadership.
Yeah, in fact, it's worse. In May, 400 members of Congress, the House and Senate, many of them Democrats, if not most of them Democrats, including Cory Booker and Kamala Harris, signed a letter to Donald Trump calling on him to get tougher with Iran. I mean, can you believe it? I mean, Trump isn't bullying that country, you know, behaving in an ultra-provocative way, pulling out of a personal but perfectly reasonable nuclear accord, and the Democrats want him to actually get tougher.
No, it's absolutely shocking. We'll find out on Thursday, I guess Wednesday and Thursday evenings at the first Democratic debates, where some of these candidates stand and if anybody will speak out against war in Iran. But we'll take a quick break here. This is Bob Schlehuber filling in for Dr. Wilmer Leon. You've been listening to Daniel Lazar, the author of several books, including America's Undeclared War, Frozen Republic, Velvet Coup. Daniel, thank you so much for joining us. Thank you for listening. We'll be back right after this. You are listening to The Critical Hour with Dr. Wilmer Leon. I am Bob Schlehuber filling in for today here on Radio Sputnik in Washington, D.C. We continue our conversation here on The Critical Hour in Istanbul. President Erdogan of Turkey suffered the biggest defeat of his political career on Sunday as his candidate for Istanbul mayor conceded defeat in a repeat election. The result wrests control over Turkey's largest city from Mr. Erdogan and ends his party's 25-year dominance in the largest city in Turkey. Opponents say such a loss cracks the president's aura of invincibility, showing that his grip on power after 16 years is weakening. We're joined by Dr. Clarence Lusain to talk more about the defeat there that Erdogan faced and whether or not he is starting to crack at his political legacy in the country. Dr. Clarence Lusain, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Well, as I mentioned, the AK party has had dominance over the city of Istanbul over the last 25 years, a striking blow to President Erdogan here. They reran the election that they said had been riddled with ballot irregularities and other corrupt practices just a few months ago. And Erdogan thought by running the race again, he would be able to unseat the main opposition party and the mayor-elect Ekrem İmamoğlu of the Republican People's Party. He had won that initial election by 13,000 votes. And this time, as votes closed on Sunday, there was up by 775,000 votes by a margin of 54% to 45%. Let me ask you first here. The election was largely seen as Erdogan's attempt to win back the city. However, that effort failed remarkably. Why do you think it was that Erdogan was not able to win back the mayoral seat there in Istanbul?
Well, obviously a big mistake in redoing the election. Erdogan, came out of Istanbul. That was, you know, the city that launched him back in, 2002 or so into the presidency. So he's always kind of had a sense that, that was his city. But what's been occurring over the last particularly 4 or 5 years has been AKP has been losing urban support. Basically, Erdogan is suffering from his own success. When he became head of the country, it was a period where the economy was expanding, and you could see the city changing. I spent a little bit of time in Istanbul, that it was basically developing. And so you begin to get more middle class, more educated people, not only in Istanbul, but in other cities as well. And as Erdogan has become more authoritarian, and has become more open in attacking people he considers his enemies, whether it was the media or human rights activists, he's begun to alienate people in urban areas. It should be noted that not only did AKP lose Istanbul in the second round, but they also lost Ankara, which is the second largest city in Turkey, and they also lost or were not able to win Izmir, which is the third largest city in Turkey. So there's been an accumulating and growing and effective opposition to Erdogan.
I think you've alluded to it a little bit here in your answer, but what do you think this means for Erdogan's efforts to de-secularize the country?
Well, it's kind of a mix because in some ways he's more like Trump in that it's not as much a party about politics as much as a party about him. And so there's been a coalition of different forces within AKP. But to some degree, the hardliners, and particularly the part of the party that's in rural areas in Turkey, has ascended. So you get a mix of some folks who came with Erdogan early, who wanted to desecularize, and now you're getting a kind of growth in that. And so you had moderates who have left or basically been driven out of the party as Erdogan has been, I think, scrambling to try to find, you know, what pieces he can put together to basically kind of stay in power.
Yeah, and his efforts to stay in power will always mean forming coalitions and working with opposition when necessary. After the election results were in and the Turkish former prime minister, Binali Yildirim, had seceded the election, Erdogan said, "My rival seems to be leading the election. I congratulate him. This elections show democracy is functioning in Turkey. I wish him well, and I hope that he'll make good services to people. For his good services, we will help him." Do you think Erdogan is being sincere in working with the opposition there in Istanbul, or is he obviously just playing nice there for the cameras after the big loss?
I think he's being sincere in trying to figure out what strategies will work so that it doesn't really look like the defeat that it was. Because this was pretty astounding blowback against Erdogan, who's basically been fairly popular. But the economy has, you know, went up and down over the last few years. And then there have been some big setbacks. One of which, for example, the whole move around Turkey becoming part of the EU, which when Erdogan came into power, that had been a critical discussion going on with the European Union. And then in part because of bigotries on the part of parts of Europe, but also because of Turkey's human rights record, that kind of never happened. But that kind of lingers out there. Turkey is a part, though, of the Council of Europe, which is the other big European international federation. And they have been playing a role. They were election observers both for the election in March and then for the recent election. So Erdogan is not just kind of playing on the field of Turkey, but he's also playing kind of international. And we know he's aligned himself with Trump as well.
Well, let's stick on there real quick on the international issue and moving away from the elections before. I do want to swing back and ask a few more questions about Istanbul and the economy there in Turkey. Where is Turkey right now as a country when it comes to international affairs, and where does it align itself? You are saying that it is positioned itself to work with Donald Trump, but at the same time, you've seen parts and forces within Turkey trying to buy weapons from Russia and looked elsewhere to kind of a global player that they don't necessarily need to ally simply on the United States as its kind of big brother and protector, but actually trying to go out on its own and find its own identity. But yet at the same time, with these recent studies, struggles of Erdogan within the country, it's hard for him to make a strong move internationally. So where do you think that Turkey sits currently with its international portfolio?
Well, it's in a bit of a tricky situation, in part, this goes back to some of the contradiction around the proposed EU membership. Turkey has one foot in Europe and it has one foot in the Middle East. And how it steps with those 2 feet has been pretty tricky. If you look in the eastern part of Turkey, there's been a very strong Islamicist politics, both from extremists who've been there, who've been fighting the Kurds and who've been blowing up stuff. But you also got Erdogan trying to tack towards that. but also the West, which is very European-oriented, particularly Istanbul, and he also has had to deal with that. A part of it has to do with trying to keep the economy on a stable footing, and it's been kind of up and down the last couple of years, not that different from other places around the world, but it's a departure from what had been a growing economy on the part of Turkey for the last decade or so. I think the alliance with Trump is based on Erdogan feeling he's got a strong partner who will essentially not call him to task on some of the human rights kinds of issues as long as he essentially kind of toes the Trumpian line around, you know, range of global issues.
There was a boost in the economy after the opposition party was able to win Istanbul in the major win. Do you think there'll be a large boost for the economy now that Istanbul is under the control of a new party? I mean, the city alone is roughly 15 million people, home of about a fifth of the country's 80 million people. And so the city is extremely powerful when it comes to economics. Do you think they'll see a boost in the economic situation, or will it actually destabilize things more as Erdogan almost needs kind of a united front to address the whole economic situation that with another party in rule of this major city that it's going to throw his game off its plans?
Yeah, I tend to lean more towards the latter, in part because I think it's going to be difficult for Erdogan to get his base to basically kind of come on board. While he has given some public acknowledgement to the opposition and kind of cheering them on, the reality, as you say, is that it's the country as a whole. And the economic trends that are impacting Turkish economy are not just because he's authoritarian, but it has to do with, you know, it's been unable to really kind of sustain growth, particularly like in financial sectors, banking, those kind of areas. Again, part of this is global pressure and global trends that are just difficult to manage. And so Turkey is going to be caught up in that, in a sense, regardless of what may happen in Istanbul.
Given all of this that's going on now for Erdogan, I'm curious if you think he is slipping from power, or if he's going to see some more chips in his armor, and if these wins here for the Republican People's Party, both in Ankara as well as Istanbul, are going to make a big difference. Is somebody like İmamoğlu in Istanbul able to unify the party there? They obviously did much better in 2014 in the presidential elections as a party than they did in 2018. So a little bit on the decline as a party there in the last presidential election. But is something like this what that party needed, the Republican People's Party needed, to swing back into some more force as an opposition party?
Well, I think it's a little bit tricky for the opposition because there's a lot of opposition. One of the things that helped İmamoğlu, hope I'm not mispronouncing the name too much, win was that there was a major Kurdish party that set out the election that would have clearly drawn votes. Now, probably not pulled into that 800,000 that we're seeing, but it's still a very divided electorate. And Erdogan doesn't come up for election, I think, to 2023. So he's got another 4 years or so where he can tactically pull back from some of the authoritarian steps that he's taken. He can make nice, basically, with the new opposition in power and hope that the economy stabilizes. And if he does that, then he has a pretty good chance of winning the election, again, sans any gigantic missteps along the way. Again, outside of the urban areas, and there's a lot outside of the urban areas, he still is fairly popular, and his party has basically been winning. So once you get outside those urban areas, the party, the AKP, is still pretty strong.
You've been listening to Dr. Clarence Lusane and Bob Schlaber filling in for Dr. Wilmer Leon on the Critical Hour. We'll take a short break and we'll be back right after this. And And we are back here with the Critical Hour with Dr. Wilmer Leon. I'm Bob Schlaber, filling in for the hour. Dr. Wilmer Leon will be back with you tomorrow here on Radio Sputnik in Washington, D.C. We turn our attention now to the Democratic primary. It's still going, yes, and it's still going for another, oh my goodness, a year and 5 months out before the presidential election. And it will be in February 2019 of 2020 that the Democrats will face one of their toughest primaries there in South Carolina. South Carolina was the home of James Clyburn's world-famous fish fry this year, held on the banks of the Congaree River. This has been an obligatory stop for Democratic contenders aiming to win over the city and state voters. This year, 21 of the 23 candidates vying for the Democratic nomination made it there. We'll talk about one of the two candidates that wasn't able to make it for other reasons. But first, let's talk a little bit, Schermichael, about the 4,400 pounds worth of deep fried fish that was eaten there at Mr. Clyburn's world famous fish fry. A big state there. A lot of people are actually seemingly looking past New Hampshire and Iowa and putting a lot of stake there in South Carolina as kind of a bellwether for where black voters will turn out. It seemed like Elizabeth Warren, Kamala Harris, Bernie Sanders had most likely the best of weekends, while others continue to struggle to make a name for themselves. I'm curious if you had any takeaways from the weekend fish fry, and if you think candidates will look past Iowa and New Hampshire and instead focus on South Carolina.
Well, look, I think thanks for having me, Bob. I think that a lot of the candidates realize that the campaign, at least on the Democratic side, officially does indeed take off in South Carolina. And the reason I say this is because you cannot win the Democratic nomination without securing strong support from within the African-American community. And so I think that there are some candidates who will say, well, maybe I cannot perform very well in maybe in Iowa or maybe in New Hampshire, but I can potentially rebound in a South Carolina. And because it is so important, because of the large percentage of African-American voters who are registered Democrats there, that they would argue that could propel them onward to potentially still being competitive for the nomination. So overall, I think Joe Biden, despite his rough week, still had a pretty solid day there from individuals that I spoke to who are long-term strategists in the state. Elizabeth Warren has even seen her numbers slowly tick up by specifically targeting African-American women. And in fact, actually eating away at some of Bernie Sanders' support, who's actually beginning to see his numbers drop in the poll as a result of Elizabeth Warren. And Kamala Harris is actually also starting to slowly build a steady but solid, robust campaign infrastructure and operation within the state. All of the other candidates, for some odd reason, they just haven't quite been able to really make their mark with African-American voters.
I do want to kind of break down there the Warren v. Sanders and the Biden versus Harris, if I may, and maybe those aren't the best pairings to pit off against each other. But let's start there. Why do you think Warren is able to chip away at some of Sanders' support around progressive, left-leaning black women or black people in general? Is Warren gaining traction, or do you see Sanders kind of losing steam, that it was him being new on the scene in 2016 brought a lot of excitement, a new message, but now Elizabeth Warren, obviously not the same message, but close enough that people are just looking for a new candidate? Or do you think she's offering something exceptionally new that's able to allow her to slowly move up in the polls?
I think it's a combination of both things, right? I think Bernie Sanders is not new. We've heard his message before, and he didn't quite win it the last time. And so I think voters are looking for someone who they believe can bring it home. Also, I think Elizabeth Warren, if you actually look at her policies, she's actually released very, very nuanced and specific policies that particularly address only African-Americans, particularly African-American women. She had a whole week or two or maybe even 3 weeks, if I recall correctly, where she released a policy that specifically addressed the healthcare crisis with African-American women during pregnancy, how they're more likely to die during childbirth than white American women. That's a very big issue for a lot of black women, particularly, as you may know, black women really are, in many instances, not all, but in many instances, according to most legitimate data, they're typically the heads of households in many black communities. So Elizabeth Warren was very smart to recognize that. She's also started to focus on the whole criminal justice reform issue, again, releasing very detailed and specific policies about criminal justice reform and policing. That's another issue that is of concern to not only African-American women and mothers, but it is also of concern to African-American men who are disproportionately impacted by the criminal justice reform or by the criminal justice process, if you will. So when you sort of compare what Elizabeth Warren is doing, and even if you were to compare what Bernie Sanders did in 2015 and 2016, even compared to what he's doing now, she is actually targeting individuals based upon very niche and nuanced issues. And not only is she saying, this is what I want to do, she's releasing policies to show this is how I will actually get it done. And those are very, very distinct things. I think people at this point in time are sort of tired of lip service, particularly African-Americans. They want to know, okay, we know that you support this because you're a Democrat, but how will you accomplish this? How will this work its way through the legislative process? And she's been very, very good about actually detailing that. And I would argue that you haven't really seen Bernie Sanders do that as much, and you haven't been able to see him do it in a way that's effective. Some of his ideas, I would argue, to a lot of African Americans, sort of seem like, oh, these are great ideas if we live in a utopia. But the reality is, we don't think that any of these things could be accomplished on the scale that Bernie has discussed them. So again, I think it's because of Elizabeth Warren's specifics. And I also think it's because Bernie Sanders is not new. He's been around, and we've sort of heard that message before. And I think people are looking for someone who they believe can actually bring it home, which is why I think Elizabeth Warren is starting to see her numbers increase and why I think Bernie Sanders is starting to see his numbers sort of level out.
I mean, Sanders did march on Washington. Was that not enough for the black vote? Is that what you're saying? He needs to do more beyond his walk there in 1963?
Well, of course. And, you know, and if you remember, Bob, even when he sort of they released that picture, I think the first time around when he ran, you know, there was even some questionable things about that, if you remember.
Yeah.
Some folks said, well, was it really him? You know, was he really there? How much activism did he really do? Was he involved? And then some folks said, well, it appears that he's pandering. This is when he was running against Hillary Clinton, and he was really trying to do every single thing he could to get some to eat away at her strong support within the African-American community. And so that was a complete failure in my part. It appeared to be pandering, and it also there were a lot of questions about was it really him. And not just questions from people within the African-American community. I mean, there were folks like writers at the New York Times, the Washington Post, literally pinning papers on what people are wondering, is that really Bernie Sanders? Yeah. So anytime people have the question, Bob, if you were actually there, that should tell you you're in a little bit of trouble.
Yeah, and it's strange. I mean, the criticisms of Sanders going towards the black vote in 2016 were well circulated and articulated to him, but for whatever reason, he's not able to get over that mental block or whatever it is to properly address him. And Warren is taking the lane, as you're saying. I want to turn here talking about Biden and Harris. For me, the two split votes, and they're both coming from or at least need the same votes to win. I'm curious if you think there's a path for Kamala Harris to overcome Joe Biden if Biden stays in the race as is, or if Harris will need Biden to drop out a major gaffe or two on top of the 7 or 8 he's already made. But is that Harris's best chances if Biden gets pushed out one way or another to overcome him? Or do you think Kamala Harris on her own has enough juice that would be able to pass up Biden as well as the rest of the field?
On her own, I would say no. And I base this on a couple of things. From my understanding and reporting and looking at some of the financial reports, you know, she is having some struggles in the fundraising area. That's always a good indication of the viability of a campaign. It's still early. The debates are coming up. I think she is going to perform fairly well, which more than likely will help her in the fundraising area. It'll also help with bringing more attention to her, where people will probably begin to pay more attention to her campaign and her candidacy. They may see her as a bit of a more viable candidate if she does perform as well as I suspect she will. But I think if you look at a recent Ipsos poll that just came out about a week ago for Democrats, most registered Democrats said that when you ask them about the gender of a candidate or even the ethnicity of a candidate, those things come second and third place to who can beat Donald Trump. That is the number one priority and focus of most Democratic voters, regardless of their orientation, regardless of their race, regardless of where they are in the country. They want to know, can you beat Trump? And I think a lot of people look at what occurred in 2016, and a lot of voters will say, well, Hillary Clinton did win the popular vote. But when you look at the states that Hillary Clinton lost, that President Obama won twice, why did she lose those places? And people look at the margins by which she lost to Donald Trump. For example, he won Florida by just 100,000 votes. You look at places like Pennsylvania, Wisconsin, and those other key states, and you're talking in some places 44,000 difference in votes. I mean, you're talking 1% in these cases. Those aren't very wide margins. And so people are saying, well, who's the best person who can turn out, the maximize the turnout in those places so that Trump, even if it's by 1%, but we want Trump to lose. And they look at Biden as having the ability to communicate to those disaffected Democratic voters who actually, believe this or not, voted for President Obama twice and voted against Hillary Clinton for President Trump, or they stayed home. People are saying, who can bring those folks back under the Democratic camp? And right now, they see Joe Biden as being that individual. And I know a lot of people are saying, you know, oh, Joe Biden is talking about yesteryears, or oh, Joe Biden is talking about bringing things back to normal. Well, Bob, that's what people want. People want the process to work the way it's supposed to work. The notion that we've surpassed normality and we just need to get used to that, that's not what people want, because if that's the new normal, then the process itself cannot work. And I think most Democratic voters understand that. And so while Joe Biden, I would argue, needs to do a little more to excite younger voters within the Democratic Party, hopefully he'll do that, I would imagine, by trying to release some policies that specifically talk to younger voters in the Democratic Party. But again, I think voters are looking at Biden right now, which is why you see his numbers so high with African-American voters. You see his numbers so high with Democratic voters writ large as the person to beat. And so for Kamala Harris, they have to either continue to have a few fumbles and see his numbers decline, or she's going to have to do what I think she is likely going to do this Wednesday and Thursday, have a stellar performance at the Democratic debate, Thursday is when she's on. And I think that will help bolster her numbers. That will help bolster her fundraising dollars. But I'm just not convinced yet at this time, Bob, that she will be able to surpass Joe Biden without him making further mistakes, because he is perceived as the best person to beat Donald Trump again, because people believe he can win back those states that Hillary Clinton lost.
Yeah, I completely agree with the fundraising totals. And it's remarkable to think that we're 7 months away from the Iowa caucus. Kamala Harris has raised about $22 million, and that's not enough. I mean, to think $22 million in a presidential race 7 months out in any other election season, you'd be smiling with the biggest grin on your face. And I completely agree. I think the Democrats need a surge candidate. I think they need somebody exciting, like you're saying. I don't think that's going to be Biden at the end of the day. And I hear you on his need to reach out to younger voters, but what's that message going to be? And obviously, we've seen Joe Biden over and over again not being able to undo Joe Biden, right? I mean, time he apologizes, it's a half-hearted apology. If there's an apology, every time he's called out for something, he explains it away and he struggles. I know we just have a few minutes left with you here. I did want to touch on one of those two candidates that was not at the fish fry there in South Carolina. Obviously, I'm talking about Montana Governor Steve Bullock. No, I'm just kidding, everyone. Obviously, that's not who we're talking about. We're talking about the other guy. The mayor, Pete Buttigieg of South Bend, Indiana, was called away from the fish fry to face some tough conversations in his hometown there in Indiana after the police killing of a black man last week. Yesterday, the 2020 presidential candidates held a town hall for a crowd of folks at the time were booing and shouted over him. Mayor Pete answered questions calmly as he could, acknowledging the lack of trust between the black community in South Bend and the police. We're talking about the need for people to need the black vote here within the Democratic Party. I don't know what this is going to do for Pete Buttigieg, but hurt him. Is there any way around this issue? And it's the other crazy thing. Half of these candidates have jobs right now as representatives or as senators. They still need to be doing their job. I mean, I don't know if anybody in the Senate's even voting on anything anymore, but Pete Buttigieg is still the mayor of South Bend. They're obviously facing issues of gentrification. They're facing issues of police accountability. And I don't want to make a big deal about Mayor Pete. I mean, he is the one running, so he's spotlighted. But we're seeing Democratic mayors across the country, LA, Chicago, Philadelphia, New York City, Washington, D.C., struggling with the same issues of gentrification and ultimately the backlash of neoliberal policies. But Pete Buttigieg has the spotlight on him. Is this an early death knell in his campaign, or is there plenty of time to recover?
No, I think this is probably going to be a death knell for him. And if I was advising one of the other Democratic candidates, this whole notion of playing fair is ridiculous to me. It's politics. I would use that to my advantage if I was advising one of the other candidates to knock him out of the race, because at the end of the day, it's politics is a blood sport. Bob, you know this. You've been reporting on politics. You know the way these things work. But I have to tell you that a lot of questions from a lot of very prominent African-American individuals, from Joe Madison on Sirius XM to the Reverend Al Sharpton to various prominent African-American pastors and activists, have been looking at those clips of him. And they're saying, you know, he tried to release his plan last week targeting African-Americans titled the Douglas Plan. And people are saying, well, if you're trying to release this nationally, why haven't you done what you're trying to do for the country in your own hometown? It just seems a bit nonsensical. You know, there's a lot of questions about the firing or demotion of the African-American police chief. I mean, he does not have a very strong relationship with African-Americans within South Bend. And so the question becomes, if the relationship is sour there, if you haven't been able to do what you're now trying to do for the entire country, then people are going to begin to wonder, one, do you really care, number one? Number two, can you really do what it takes to change race relations in this country, which are only going to get worse? And I think for a lot of African Americans, when they see that clip, when they see those clips, I've seen multiple now, they're going to say, this guy is not the right person for the job. And keep in mind, he's only polling at 4% in South Carolina. I would imagine those numbers are going to decrease as a result of his inability to handle what's going on in South Bend. And it's crazy to me that he's going back to South Carolina. I believe he's there now. And there's one such clip where at the town hall, there's an African-American gentleman who yells out, oh, of course, you can't be here because you have to go back to South Carolina. So people are saying you should be here dealing with what's going on in South Bend with African-American voters here, but instead you're trying to run for president. And so I think the ultimate question becomes this, Bob. If you can't clean up your own backyard, what in the heck makes you think you could be president of the United States with the severity of the problems that we have in this country relating to race and the issue, and other issues pertaining to black people in this country? That's a question that he cannot answer, because if he could answer it, he would be doing a much better job handling the issues that are going on in South Bend. And this is why I say this. Look at when certain race issues occurred when President Obama was in office and how he handled those things. Look at race relations that have occurred since, and look at the way that someone like a Kamala Harris has responded to them. Now, granted, these individuals aren't mayors, but what I'm trying to point out is how desperate their ability to handle these types of issues were in comparison to someone like a Mayor Pete Buttigieg. And so I just don't foresee him being able to overcome this. And I do believe that this is something that's going to hurt him. Even if he's able to stand this thing for a long time, it's going to continue to follow him, because what is happening now is there's a spotlight that's going to be on South Bend, that's going to be on him. And you're going to have reporters, you're going to have opposition researchers now from the other campaigns saying, wait a minute here, let's go to South Bend. Let's actually see what his relationship is in South Bend, where you have a lot of African Americans there who said they have been displaced because of gentrification under his leadership, and that he hasn't really done much of anything to try to stop that, to make sure that affordable housing continue to exist as housing prices continue to rise, which, as we know, typically disproportionately impacts not only African American people, Bob, but people who are poor in general, poor whites, poor Hispanics, et cetera. People are going to begin to ask those questions, and Mayor Pete's not going to be able to answer them, as he has not been able to answer what's currently going on. So, unfortunately, I think he's a very smart guy. I think he's a talented guy, but this may not be his time.
No, and just, I'm just laughing again at him calling for any black people to come out and help him after he said he needed help. And then he goes on the Breakfast Club and then the Bodega Boys and is drinking alcohol in a brown paper bag, thinking that's the way in which he's going to get to black voters. He can at least sit back and reflect a little bit. He is still 37 years old, so plenty of time, hopefully, for them to rebuild there in South Bend and do what's right for the community. You've been listening to The Critical Hour. I'm Bob Schlaber, filling in for Dr. Wilmer Leon. We're joined there by Sher Michael Singleton. Thank you so much for joining us. We'll be back after this last break. And we are back here with The Critical Hour with Dr. Wilmer Leon. I'm your guest host, Bob Schlaber, filling in for the doctor. He'll be back tomorrow with you. We continue our show now talking about the latest in the world of immigration. We're pleased to be joined by Oscar Chacon. Oscar is the co-founder and executive director of Alianza Americas.
Oscar, thank you so much for joining us.
It's a pleasure to be with you always.
Well, we wanted to talk to you about President Donald Trump's delayed Sunday immigration raids. He had planned for there to be ICE raids in nearly a dozen cities, but yet said he had delayed the raids because he wants to give Democrats, quote, every last chance, unquote, to address the immigration issues. ICE agents were expected to round up about 2,000 of what they say here in this article, illegal, I will say undocumented migrants around the country on Sunday, but Trump called off the raids. On Twitter, he warned that if progress is not made in Congress, quote, big deportation begins in 2 weeks. I mean, just sickening to read the president's Twitter that he's basically making a show and a game out of illegally kidnapping, detaining, and forcibly removing people from this country. Oscar, what are your takeaways here from why the raid itself was canceled? Do you think it was to give the Democrats every last chance to negotiate on immigration issues? Others have actually pointed to the acting Department of Homeland Security Chief Kevin McAllen of leaking ICE raid plans to the Post to actually sabotage the operation, as he didn't want to be fingered for having rounded up and arrested these migrants.
Well, my impression is that there is probably a little bit of all of what you just mentioned. I believe that there is also a couple of other factors that need to be always kept in mind. As we all know, the president has decided once again to make immigrants, immigration, Mexico front and center in his reelection bid going into 2020. And in this respect, the more mileage the president can get out of this issue, the better from his advisors, you know, point of view. They believe that by keeping this issue on and on and on and on in the news, it's helpful according to their strategy. So I do not discount that in spite of everything that we know now, in as far as what could have actually led to them announcing that they were giving 2 more weeks, I believe that there is also this issue of just keeping him in the news every day on this issue, because they are convinced that this riles up the people who are most fervently behind the notion that he should remain in the White House past 2020. And to me, that is a clear factor. On the other hand, I definitely believe that the announcement made a week ago was actually not properly vetted within the administration itself. I believe that DHS was surprised, I mean, at the president tweeting that these raids were going to be happening at the scale that he made it sound, because that's simply impossible. I mean, there is no enough human resources in place to be able to conduct anything along the lines of what the original tweet a week ago said about these raids. But I also believe that this is another classical example of a president that generates a crisis himself and then offers to diffuse the crisis as the quid pro quo for getting what he wants anyway. What he's been trying to get from Democrats, and I hope that Democrats stand strong in denying such a thing, is to make the notion of seeking asylum even more meaningless than it has become, simply because the president would like to be able to decide entirely on their own without any kind of review about decisions being made, and he wants this to become law. So the Democrats would be, frankly, not helping people seeking refuge, people seeking protection, which is very much the case for Central Americans coming up northward, if they were to agree to this notion. So I really hope that, again, they don't allow him to get away with creating a crisis and then using that very crisis as the payback for a change that he was looking for going back at least a couple of years ago.
I'm kind of curious, and how much of this is a new to Donald Trump, the scare tactics, the process in which he's going about, but then how much of it is just America being America? If you look at the October and November 2015 immigration roundup and deportation numbers under President Barack Obama, there was just over 12,500 families were apprehended in those 2 months of 2015, compared with 4,500 during the same 2 months in 2014. Meanwhile, 10,588 unaccompanied children were apprehended at the southern border in October and November of 2015. And this is according to federal officials. That's more than double the number of minors who tried to cross into the United States in that 2014 time period. So a lot of this is framed as Donald Trump's doing this horrible new thing. Democrats are going to fight with him, so then he has to negotiate back and forth. But yet the Democratic Party's last president was doing similar things in similar fashions with the similar numbers. So maybe tell me a little bit more about what's similar between Donald Trump and Barack Obama when it comes to these numbers being so similar, and maybe what's new about how Donald Trump's actually going about doing this.
Well, first of all, I'm glad that you're bringing up the fact, and we have said this, I have said this many times, that anybody who may be thinking that it was Donald Trump who became mean against foreign nationals that are seeking refuge, including unaccompanied children, need to go back and read their history better, because in reality, these policies have been with us for a long time. Actually, they go back, frankly, to the very end of the 1980s, and they have only been getting worse decade after decade. And indeed, President Obama, remember, has gone into history as the U.S. president who removed the largest number of people from the U.S. And frankly, the vast majority of them, the only infraction they have committed is to be in the U.S. without visas, not because they were criminal in any practical way you and I or everybody else may think about it. But the reality is that the difference that we see from those days and what we are seeing now under President Trump is that the level of rhetoric that we see associated with these actions is much higher. And simply, we believe that this is the result of a presidency that is very closely intertwined with white supremacist movements. A lot of the people who have been the most active supporters of Trump are actually people who embrace, I mean, these type of extremist ideas. And so the more they can essentially heighten the conversation and place this conversation in the context of, you know, nobody ever did this before, they are simply helping their own case, because they really believe that by heightening this kind of discourse, they will succeed in getting more people excited about President Trump becoming reelected in 2020. So that is the essential difference that I do see. But again, I'm glad you're bringing up, you know, recent history to the fact that, yes, there were tons of people removed, including families, including unaccompanied children, under the administration of Barack Obama. That is simply a fact.
Yeah, and I guess I'm kind of curious. I think there's a huge need, obviously, to call attention to what Donald Trump has done to bolster white supremacists and the far right, who are very militant and would be happily being violent towards migrants. But I also want to criticize and at least critique liberals and even progressives, because this fear-mongering does a lot to everyone. It's not just those on the far right that play into the fear-mongering, but it is the liberals and some progressives that say, well, maybe I don't want these gangs coming into our country and preying on my small child. Are my towns already struggling with unemployment rates, and do we need more migrants competing for these jobs? And it muddies the water quite a bit. And obviously, a lot of the Democratic base either knew enough about what Barack Obama was doing or actually endorsed it to allow him to do what he did while he was president. So I'm kind of curious, does this not have a larger impact on society writ large beyond just the far right?
I believe so. I frankly believe that the common denominator in a wider segment of the American public is the fact that we have been enduring at a very slow motion pace what I call, you know, growing economic insecurity, growing social insecurity that is felt broadly by a lot of people. And so, of course, you know, when people are feeling the effects of a society that has become less equal than we used to be, and far more full of fear about what the future will bring, it does not feel well, you know, to embrace the idea that there should be more foreign nationals coming. On the other hand, I mean, I think it is important to acknowledge that the fears that a lot of people have above and beyond those who have embraced, you know, white nationalism in an extremist manner, are fears that have nothing to do with immigrants or immigration. And this is the part that I believe liberals have actually failed to actually communicate in a way that makes sense, that makes people be heard, or at least get the perception that they are being heard, because we have not made a good case in terms of presenting what is it that makes broad segments of the population feel so full of fear, insecurity. And believe me, it has nothing to do with foreign nationals or immigration. There are other critical issues that we need to look at, including the fact that wages in the U.S. have not really kept up, you know, with inflation over the past four decades. Even though there are more jobs being created, the quality of the jobs being created are not anywhere near what they used to be. And so the sense of the perception people have about how safe am I in terms of an economic and social condition, does not necessarily lead to people having the best feelings regarding solidarity with foreign nationals. But I insist, these fears have nothing to do with immigrants or immigration per se.
Yeah, and I'm curious here if our last few minutes of the psychological impacts of the announced and then canceled ICE raids on migrants themselves and undocumented people here in this country. Obviously, raids didn't happen, but just the mere fear of them happening is one thing. And then just a continued inability for people and the media and Donald Trump and others to fully embrace migrants coming to this country, that has to play a huge role on the day-to-day lives of undocumented people. So speak a little bit to what it's like to be undocumented in the United States in the time of Donald Trump.
Well, most definitely, the level of anxiety that people who are residing in this country, working hard, paying taxes, but without the proper documentation from an immigration standpoint of view, they definitely feel, you know, the uncertainty, especially for those who are parents and have U.S.-born children. The notion that they may go out to work this morning but not have the certainty that they will come back and not necessarily having made the best of plans about their kids. You can imagine how troublesome this can be for any parent. So for immigrants, this is definitely a big concern, on top of the fact that immigrants, like everybody else, is also facing the fact that we are functioning in a labor market that is full of uncertainties. And so on top of everything that average Americans deal with, immigrants have to also worry about uncertainty as to whether will I see my kids at the end of the day. So that is heartbreaking, especially when we know that there are not enough outlets to ensure that if people are arrested, that they will have the possibility to make their case in immigration court, and they will likely just be very swiftly deported back to countries they've been gone for a long time.
And that will do it with our time here with Oscar Chacon. Oscar, again, is the co-founder and executive director of Alianza Americas. Check out their work if you want to learn more about how you can support and help those who are fighting for legal status here in the United States. That's going to do us for the hour. I'm Bob Schlaber. I was filling in for Dr. Wilmer Leon today on the Critical Hour. Dr. Wilmer will be back tomorrow with a brand new episode of the Critical Hour. You're listening to Radio Sputnik on Washington, D.C. We'll see you next time.